Spirituality Center presents Muffin Talk with Beate. Kia ora and welcome to our Muffin Talk. Muffin Talk is brought to you by the Mercy Spirituality Center in Ipsum. We are a center for retreats, spiritual guidance, Christian meditation and personal development. Once a week, I invite a visitor to join me in the studio to talk about our center, our programs, social justice, the mercy world, or the Catholic Church. Today, my visitor is Father Kevin Waldie. Father Kevin, a warm welcome and hi to my radio program.
Thank you very much, Beata.
Father Kevin is a Marist father and he's originally from Timaru, the South Island of New Zealand, and is lecturing in Bible studies at Good Shepherd College. He has come to Muffin Talk a few times, and I'm also happy that he's going to give talks again at the Mercy Spirituality Center. This year, Father Kevin is giving a series of talks under the topic, A Biblical Panoramic Worldview. The next parts of the series are on the 17th of October and on the 24th of October. One question for this series that are coming up, Father Kevin. On the 17th of October, you'll focus on St. Luke the Evangelist and St. Paul the Apostle. Why did you pick these two saints at the same session?
In the tradition, they're often linked together. They are not necessarily mates or friends or close associates, but what they do is that they speak to the big wide world of Greek-speaking people. And so it's got a universality about the way in which they direct their thoughts. And I think that's why we would link them together. And they often use lots of images that speak to audiences. Because what you've got to do is when you speak, you've got to capture the audience, as it were, and have them eating out of your hand, we say. And I think that's one of the tricks of the authorship of both of these men, is the fact that they know how to speak to an audience, how to use certain images, and then how to proclaim the good news.
But they didn't live at the same time, did they?
No. They're quite different decades of the first century. So Paul is the man who leads the way, as it were. He's the foundational figure in the writing part of the New Testament. And then you've got Luke, who's someone working towards the end of the first century CE. So quite different decades, quite different phases of the early church, if you like. Some people probably wouldn't want to say that the first century has phases, but I think it does, in the sense that once the early church has settled into thinking and theologizing, someone like Luke comes along and he's a very sophisticated writer and man able to deal with the message and proclaim it in a very specific way and do it distinctively with materials that are unique to him. And that comes, I think, from thinking, reflecting, professing what you believe.
So they didn't know each other, but maybe one read of the other.
That's right. Some people would claim they didn't know each other, but in actual fact, I think they're quite different personalities, in a sense, and figures that live in different parts of the first century.
So they're connected.
Yeah, they're connected. They're obviously proclaiming the gospel, because that's the word that Paul uses quite frequently, the word gospel itself, or good news, as we say in English. But the word is just one word in Greek, and of course it comes from the similar word that's in the Hebrew of the Old Testament.
Mm-hmm. For those of you who just tuned in, you're listening to Muffin Talk with Beate. This program is brought to you by the Mercy Spirituality Center in Ipsum. If you miss any of our programs, please check out www.planetaudio.org.nz/muffintalk or visit our website or Facebook page at Tengaka Waiora Mercy Spirituality Center. Today, my visitor is Father Kevin Waldie, and we have today the 21st of September. That's the feast day of St. Matthew, the Apostle and Evangelist. We just mentioned St. Luke, the Evangelist, and St. Paul, the Apostle. St. Matthew is named both Apostle and Evangelist. Does this make him even more special?
I don't think, I wouldn't put it that way, no. I'd say he's one of the unique characters, in a sense, of the first century. because he's writing from his own perspective, and that then makes him somewhat special. But I would think that he has a skill that compares with the skill of Luke, but they're really writing for different audiences. And therefore, you can see what's happening in the early church as each of these individuals works with people and then proclaims the message and sort of defines the message for them. They have a different style and a different set of stories, a different set of expressions and creedal statements that they're going to rely upon. So that would be my response, really.
So St. Matthew, who was he? Is this the same St. Matthew, the tax collector, who was eager to meet Jesus and invite him into his house? Was it the same person, the St. Matthew the evangelist?
This is the big question, of course, for biblical scholars. The debates around Matthew have gone on for a number of years in the modern biblical critical world. So therefore, there is a sense whereby you'd say, well, perhaps if he's one of these Galilean personalities, that is from the north of the Holy Land, and he's a fisherman or a type like that, or comes from that sort of background, perhaps he wouldn't be quite as skilled as an author. And so you'd probably make a distinction about the apostle, strictly speaking, and then the evangelist. But I think in the tradition, we've added another title into the picture, and I think you might have mentioned it before in the opening to today, that I would put three titles alongside his name: tax collector, apostle, and evangelist. And the way the church then remembers the person called Matthew is to play upon that threefold sense, if you like. And the idea is then that when we look back at the history books, as it were, we find very little information about a number of the early church members. And Matthew is a typical character from the early church that we know little of. So when you say, what do we know about him? Very little, I'd say. But the fact is that his name's recorded as an apostle. And, of course, eventually the gospel that's ascribed to him has the tag on it. But early on, they didn't need to write their name on it, as it were, because everyone knew who was writing this text, because it was for a very specific community. But afterwards, once it becomes a text, say the gospel does, a text that is going to be available to a much broader audience, so not the original one, but members of this growing community right across the face of the Roman Empire, then you see that it takes on a different air, as it were. And so I would say then, what you really know about Matthew, you really have to go back to the gospel that's dedicated to his name. And I think when you start with the word tax collector, then you get something of an orientation to the world out of which he came, and also then the author of the gospel is speaking from a background that's very Jewish and traditionally Jewish. And so it'll use terminology that is coming out of that world. And I think that's the thing that you say, we might not know a lot about the historical person, but I would suggest we should go to the gospel and then try and see if we can discern who the person is behind the gospel. And that's one way that we become familiar with a person, because every author leaves their trademark on the text. And often when we speak, when I speak, etc., people get to know how I communicate, the sort of language I use, how I gesticulate a little bit, and how I perform, as it were. Because you got to target your audience. You know who you're talking to and how you have to explain certain things. So I think that when you look at someone speaking, you also look at the text that someone's written in the same manner, and you often can almost discern when you read someone's text what kind of a person they are. And when you know the person, you see the type of language they use frequently, lots of things, characteristic phrases, etc., etc. And I think, therefore, you come right at it and you know someone well, even though it's not written down in historical documented evidence.
Sometimes when you have this name, like text collector, this by name, you would think of, that shows already that he has some kind of education, that he knows how to read and write and calculate. So he's not a fisherman.
So.
And it also, usually a text collector would have a good memory. And because he would remember if somebody paid, even he could check. And that might be one hint that helps to understand that he wrote down certain things that he heard of, that he might have seen, or that he might have witnessed.
Exactly. And I think you're right on there, because what we have to understand is that he's not actually literally writing it down, because I think I might have explained this before, that authors dictated their texts, because you know the way of writing down and preparing all the materials for writing things down was a highly technical expert's job. And so therefore you had scribes whose particular vocation it was to do this writing, whereas we often think of an author writing down or using a computer now, but actually being the original writer of the text, whereas we'd say these are the authors. That is, they are the ones who have inspired the text. They are the ones who have dictated it, and their authority stands behind the text. So, you know, there's a little subtle distinction there about who's the real author. And so that's why I think the early church didn't really record too much about, say, the original apostles or the authors, because it's actually about Jesus Christ. And therefore, what you've got to concentrate on is communicating the right things about the person of Jesus. And that would be my thing too, that you have to have that in mind constantly, that the early church is an offshoot of Judaism, you know, of the Jewish faith. So therefore, it's something about the first century as well that you've got to keep in mind, so that everything after Paul is written in the light of the destruction of Jerusalem in 70 CE. So when the Roman Empire comes in and wipes Jerusalem off the face of the earth, then there is a moment of new beginning. But it's also something that over a few decades after the death of Jesus, it's now a time for the early Christian community to take greater shape, as it were, and start spreading itself. And the Jews are going to do the same because of the Pharisees, who have preserved their writings and going to sponsor basically the move forward. So there's an establishment of a moving forward that's going to pick up what they believe and forge a new way of being either a Jew or, as it's going to be, Christian. And, of course, in the Christian community, there are going to be great debates about what it is to be a Christian. Do you have to be a Jew first in order to be initiated into this community? And so the different authors then are going to come at that from different angles. And so, therefore, we decide, therefore, that in the Christian calling, everyone is initiated into the faith community in the same way, rather than, say, through circumcision. That becomes the model of the faith that comes down from Abraham. So, you know, you've got a few distinctions you have to make, but it's clear enough, I think, that you're dealing with a community sort of trying to feel its way through the trauma of a destructive period in the Holy Land in the first century, and then gradually picking up and running with the good news, as it were. And whether the good news is of the Jewish side or the Christian side, they're both making progress forward. And that will be the story of history as well, that the Jewish and Christian communities will have split apart totally, but in actual fact, they are going down parallel tracks because they've got the same sort of foundational materials and often inspiring leaders and preachers and teachers.
And also when you said that the destruction of Jerusalem was just beforehand, they would have had a lot of people who died in the destruction. And so producing something in a written form makes it more possible, makes it easier to then copy that written form to many other copies and distribute it around the world.
That's right.
Whereas if you have only a few people who know, and if they perish, then there's nothing left.
I think everyone was wanting to know what had happened, and therefore they write the Gospels in the light of the historical moments that occur in the first century. And I think that's a very important factor to keep in mind as you read these texts, that they might be some decades out from the life and death of Jesus, but they're preserving a tradition and lots of traditions about what Jesus said and did. But then also they're writing those down for a completely new generation that now will go forward and forge a new life, and the life that we know from Matthew is about the kingdom, the coming of the kingdom, and the kingdom to which we are destined to live eternally.
Is the Gospel of Matthew related to the Gospel of Luke? Is there a correlation?
There's certainly a lot of material that they share in common, and that's where modern biblical scholars would start to sort out how they relate to each other, so that Mark is often now thought to be the foundational text that both Luke and Matthew used. And so they basically pick that up, and then they combine that with sort of their own traditions, so their very own special materials. But then there's another source, we say, that holds material that Matthew and Luke actually record and sometimes do it exactly word for word. So we don't have that source, but obviously something's preserved in both Matthew and Luke that makes them sound, on occasion, very much alike. But we know then that we've got to read the whole gospel of each author in order to really understand how those materials work within that context. And that's why I'd say, you know, you've got Mark, that's a pretty simple gospel.
The shortest,
16 chapters. Whereas you can understand what I'm saying when you realize that Matthew's got 28 chapters and Luke's got 24. And then, of course, Luke's got a second volume, which, you know, is going to go for 28 chapters as well.
Mark leave out the infancy story?
That's right. The whole thing is, therefore, what was Mark doing in writing his gospel? Well, fundamentally, the gospel, in a nutshell there, is that Jesus suffered, died, and rose again. So the cross is the major image that Mark's dealing with. So really, you've got an abbreviated collection of memories that he's preserving. He often talks about the fact that Jesus taught a lot, but you don't get a lot of teaching, whereas you get a lot of actions, a lot of deeds. Now, when you come across into Matthew and Luke, you've got a much broader collection of Jesus' teachings. And that's why then, you know, when we look at Matthew, we notice something very specific about his text, because he's got these five major blocks of teaching that tell us something special about the community that he was addressing and also about their struggles with the faith in the first century. Now, that order of material, which starts at chapter 5, basically with what we know is called the Sermon on the Mount, and that everyone would be very familiar with that, because that is the thing that everyone can relate to rather easily. And so then Jesus goes up the mountain. Whereas when you start looking at something similar in Luke, he comes down the mountain And then he delivers a speech that's very brief, and it's nothing like Matthew's. And then you get some of that other teaching that's in the Sermon on the Mount scattered through Luke. So therefore, we've got to focus on Matthew and see that he's often writing from this Jewish perspective, that he sees the world through Jewish eyes, and he sees the person of Jesus through the eyes of the Old Testament as well. And that's one of the things that you notice, that these five blocks of teaching are playing on the motif that Jesus is almost like a new Moses. Because you know that the first five books of the Bible, the book of Genesis through to Deuteronomy, that collection is said to be the books of Moses. And so Moses is the great prophet, the great teacher of the Jewish tradition. Now, when Jesus comes along in the Matthean tradition, he takes on the air of Moses, but he's something greater than Moses as well.
Can we say that Matthew, as he was preaching to Jewish people and they knew the Torah, the five books of Moses,
exactly,
he would relate Jesus constantly to the Torah and would take it as a proof. See, this is what happened with Jesus. This is what the Torah said. And to convince them, Jesus is the Messiah.
That's right. And this is why when you look at the real way in which he writes his gospel, you get a feel for him at the same time. But he's using phrases constantly that say, as it is written, which means that it's the word of God, or as Jesus finished these words, he said something or other, you know. And then also you've got another thing then, that this was to fulfill the law, what the Lord had spoken. And I think when you keep getting that echo effect through the gospel, you know that he's always looking back to the Torah in particular and to what has been taught there. And then when you listen to Jesus in Matthew's record of those teachings, everyone says, yes, this is the good news fulfilled. This is what Moses was really on about. He was waiting for the day when the Messiah, or what we say in Greek terms, the Christ, was going to come and do. And so that's why the fulfillment thing is a major idea that Matthew runs with constantly. And so therefore you've got to be aware that there's this constant referring backwards to the Old Testament, or to the Torah, as we would say, the teaching, the law as it is interpreted. And so what I'd say is that when you start looking more deeply into Matthew's gospel, you suddenly realize how that Torah has influenced him. And I think when you open up the gospel of Matthew, you begin with the genealogy. And most people would find that very, very difficult to understand. But once you realize that what our man is doing, Matthew's doing, is he is tracing an historical line right from Abraham down to Jesus Christ. And he's doing it in this very patterned way. And so what you find is that he divides history up into three periods. So what you've got is the first period is going to take you to King David. And so King David becomes the major king character of the Old Testament. And he's going to be remembered as that special character. Then you come another step forward and you come to the period of the Babylonian captivity, which is a bit like what Matthew's community would have undergone in 70 CE, because in the Babylonian captivity at the beginning of that, Jerusalem is wiped off the face of the earth again, the temple and the city itself are destroyed. So history repeats itself.
And then you have, like what you said, you had King David, and Jesus was born of the house of David. And Mark didn't have the infancy story, but the infancy story really connects Jesus even more to the tradition and the history of the Jewish people, and with the fleeing and...
That's right, the flight into Egypt. And because what? Because the babies have been killed, just as in chapter 1 of Exodus, in the period of Jewish slavery in Egypt, the Pharaoh sends out a decree to destroy all these male children, you see. And so what you find then is you've got another echo effect of the Moses motif, as it were, but you're also getting that through the stories that are coming out of Genesis all the time, that in particular when Joseph, who's introduced as part of the lineage, well, there's Joseph, which is a name that comes from the book of Genesis, and he's the great dreamer. So when Joseph is wondering what God is asking of him, he has all these dreams, and in those dreams he hears the message of what he's meant to do. So therefore everyone automatically relates back. And I think when you've got this melting pot of all sorts of things, even Mary's name, because her name in Hebrew is Miriam, and of course Miriam is the sister of Moses and Aaron. And what you've got then is you've got lots of things coming out of the what we call the Pentateuch Torah, coming out of the text and then bouncing about in the infancy narrative of Matthew. And so Jesus then is shown to be the beginning of a new creation, which we then would say is the coming of the Messiah, who then establishes the new people of God.
It's almost like a rational thing, and the way that it's justified or it's explained, it's like the Jewish tradition of discussing and having a proof, and there are things that cannot be proven, but majority of little details in the Bible can be proven, and they all have a meaning. And I think that also on the when you come to our center on the 24th of October, you'll talk about the five books of Moses.
That's right.
And I think that we'll also connect then to St. Matthew, because I see that our time is almost running out.
Right, good.
And we have so much to share about St. Matthew. That was only the beginning. So if anybody has more questions, I think the best thing is come to our sessions on the 17th of October and the 24th of October, and we'll learn about St. Luke, St. Paul, and the five books of Moses.
This was the repeat of an earlier broadcast. We will continue with repeats of relevant interviews until further notice. Please note that all programs at the Mercy Spirituality Center are suspended until the end of May due to the COVID-19 virus. We will review the situation constantly and will let you know when we are able to take up our programs again. Let us pray for all victims of this virus, physical, mental, emotional, and material victims. Please keep safe. Thank you.